The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey, welcome back to Breaking Banks, guys. We are live from New York today. It is June 25th. It's a nice hot day. The air conditioning is not working in the studio today, so I'm hot. So anyway, great to have you guys with us. On the news this week, of course, Accenture released a study showing that fintech investment tripled last year, $12 billion, and it's expected to triple again this year, so reaching approximately $30, $35 billion this year. Now, that spread across in the U.S., some 8,000 fintech startups. You may have heard me use this stat before. If you want to check out those stats, look at Gust and AngelList for a listing of fintech startups in the United States. But also the new .bank domain has been launched this week. So this has attracted 3,000 new applications. And one of the new banks that undoubtedly will be applying for a new .bank license is Adam in the UK, who this week received news that they will get their bank license. Now, they of course came out and said they're going to be a mobile-only bank. They're not going to have branches and they're not going to have a website. But they have a website. It's called adambank.co.uk. So I don't quite know what that was about, but we can ask the guys from Adam Bank back on the show to talk about the launch of their bank when they're ready. Some of the other news: Fifth Third Bank is going to downsize 12% of their branches here in the United States. We keep hearing this. We keep hearing big names downsizing branches. It was just 2 years ago when we were talking about this, and I was talking about suggesting that we're going to have a 50% decline in branches in the United States by the middle of next decade, that it was poo-hooed. We're already seeing the big banks make 10, 15% adjustments in their branch numbers now. Imagine what it's going to be like as mobile commerce starts to heat up. We're seeing surveys right now. The data is pretty clear right now that mobile internet has surpassed internet on desktop usage. In the UK, how this is playing out, that now half of all e-commerce transactions in the UK are now carried out on mobile devices. Interestingly, tablets are extremely popular in respect to this stuff. So in the UK, particularly for purchasing online. So that's pretty big. A few shout-outs to a few people. Just a quick shout-out to Aaron Tass from Yahoo, who just pinged me on Twitter, and who's listening to the show. And we'll have Duana Blumstrom from the FinTech Mafia up shortly. But in the meantime, let's ask Tyler from Prime to join us. Tyler, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me.
How are you, man?
Great.
So we caught up in, where was it? Where did we catch up the other week?
Austin at the Emerge Conference.
Yeah, Austin at the Emerge Conference. You guys, from Prism, you along with Steve Gordon, you guys founded Prism in 2011. You guys have this really cool, interesting bill pay and sort of machine intelligence bill pay system that you've built. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, happily. And you know, it follows along exactly the point you were making just now, that everything's moving to mobile phones and tablets, and that's where people want to do their banking and their finance. And, you know, for most people, especially in this country, banking and finance really revolves around paying bills, right? They get paid once or twice a month. They have 15 bills coming due throughout the month, and it's a nightmare to manage all of that. And so what we did is we built a product that just abstracts all of that pain away. We go out, we get all your bills, we figure out what bills you have, we show them to you in the product, we show you your bills relative to your income, and then you can pay those bills right from within the product completely for free.
And who are you working with in terms of which sort of organizations do you currently support in terms of payments today?
We support over 7,000 billers, all the big national companies from cell phone carriers and cable companies down to many smaller utility providers and electricity providers and the like, insurance companies, et cetera. And we're constantly growing that network. So our goal is to get to a point in the next year or so where if you download our app and sign up, we support 95% of the billers that you probably have right out of the box.
And tell us about how you've got these macros or algorithms that learn how to do this. Can you explain that process a little bit more?
Yeah, exactly. So, this was the big innovation of our system, and we basically built a very sophisticated machine learning system on the back end that learns how to interact with all of these different billers. And so that's what enables us to get to such large amount of support. We're a small team. We have 10 people. We support 7,000 billers, and we're adding more every day. And it's a very fault-tolerant, very sophisticated system. So we audit every bill that you pay, we provide back to the end user the confirmation number and a full audit trail. And it's all based on this very sophisticated back end that interacts with each biller in a unique way. So it's instant, the payments are processed immediately, fully auditable, and very, very scalable. So we're really proud of that system. It's pretty transparent to our users. They don't see any of it. They just hit pay bill and we take care of it. But it's quite a bit of complicated technology on the back end there.
So you actually have some humans involved in sort of priming the machine learning. Is that how it works?
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly right. We have a number of people that basically teach it the first few times, and then it can then pick up and run on its own. And part of the reason we do that is just because we are handling bills. It's very, very important that we get it right. So we like to have that little human touch at the beginning just to be sure we're doing all the right stuff, and then we trust the machines for the second and third rounds.
Cool. And what sort of volume of payments are you processing right now?
We're doing a little over $1 million of payments per day. It's lumpy. People tend to pay bills when they get paid. So Fridays, especially the middle Friday and the last Friday of each month, tend to be big spikes. But on average, we're doing a little over $1 million a day.
Great. So what's next for you guys?
The biggest next step for us is broadening the feature set of the product. Right now we're all about payments. We're all about letting you view and pay your bills, and we've been really successful with that. The next step is helping people with their money more generally. We just added, actually, a couple weeks ago, a whole new section to our product called Money. So now we're not just showing you your bills, we're also showing you your asset accounts, how much money you have, what your credit card balances are, what your store card balances are. And so we're not going to be totally PFM. We still want to keep it clean and simple and focused on cash flow management. But we're adding this money feature to it that really helps round out the view that we give our customers. And then the next step after that is just increasing features. We're soon going to enable paying any bill with a credit card, which is a heavily demanded feature by our customers. And then we're looking to expand out to extending credit, extending opportunities for savings and investment. We really view the sky as the limit in this space. There's so much potential for disruption in the personal banking space.
Absolutely. So people can check it out, prismmoney.com, right?
Yep, prismmoney.com, and just download our apps on iPhone and Android. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Brett.
Hey, thanks for giving us a heads up, Tyler, and let us know how things keep progressing.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Okay, Duana, welcome to the show.
Yes.
I should sort of say welcome back, but you haven't sort of been, you've been involved in the show, at arm's length. You make a regular appearance as a voice on one of our advertisements, actually, for Finovate. But this is the first time that we've been live with you. Talking to you. So welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself. For those who don't know who you are, obviously that's not many people, but for those of you who don't know who you are, tell us.
Thank you, Brett. So my name is Duana Brumstrom, as you said, and I'm a number of things. Until very recently, I have headed marketing and sales for a company that has been featured on your show once or twice, and won a couple of innovates called Meniga. And then I have decided to leave that and right a wrong in banking. And that wrong is the lack of conversation around emotional banking. So you can say I'm an independent consultant now, I guess. I write, I speak, and I mentor. And I'm just on this crusade of changing things from the inside out.
A crusade. There you go. And if any of you know Duana, if Duana is on a crusade, you do not want to get in her way. So look out. So let me just talk about emotional banking for a moment. Banking is an emotive subject, right? You could see after the financial crisis, there were lots of protests, people very emotive about the banks and bank bonuses and banks foreclosing and things like that. But also money is inherently an emotional thing. You know, we tend to have some very different cultures around money around the world. You know, in the US, it's not considered very polite to talk about how much you earn or how much money you have. And there's also this psychology, part of the psychology around banks has been, you remember the Northern Rock stuff happening in UK when there was a bit of fear over what was going to happen in Northern Rock. Everyone's camping outside the branch, wanting to make sure they get their money. So there's a lot of emotion. Is that the sort of emotion you're talking about, or are you talking about something else, Duana?
Partly, yes. That is part of it. But I think, as you said, it is a very emotional topic. I think it goes very deep, and I think we've missed the mark in not talking about it so far. It is one of the most important relationships we've ever had in our lives, outside of maybe love and its construct, friendship, family, and so on. The next most important thing is our relationship with money. And somehow the one institution that's supposed to be looking at this hasn't been looking at it whatsoever. So what I wanted to do was go back to those very deep topics of what is happy money, what is sad money, what makes us anxious, what gives comfort. And I had thought initially that exists already in banking, that there are teams of people doing this and focused on how consumers feel. And in the last few years that I've met tens, if not hundreds of banks, I've noticed that that's not the case. So that is what I'm attempting to do.
So is this is going to be a competency in respect to design? We talk a lot about experience design at the moment. Do you think that emotional experience design will be something that differentiates experiences?
Well, in all honesty, this should have been the job of UX departments and CX departments around the world. And somehow they have lost their way and have entered this era of deciding on colors of features and whether something should be HTML5 or not and what the resolution is. Ease of use is not experience. And talking about kind of what do our customers like in terms of features on the mobile is not really looking at what they want. Not even talking about needs is looking at what people feel. So it would have been there to do. For one reason or another, they have allowed themselves to become very technical and less than a first cousin at the table of strategy. So no one really takes experience design as seriously as they should. EX is, if you wish, the lost religion of UX. I think we should go back to it.
Sure. It's interesting because UX started out of a need to embrace, you know, users in terms of their purity, not as someone using an interface, but now staying instead, interfaces should be designed around the user, how people use it. So what you're saying is the other lens on this should be how people feel about it, should be accepted. Yeah.
It should have been the other way around, if you wish, in the sense of, I mean, we talk a lot about things like invisible banking now and something I call money moments and the way they should be flowing in and out of our lives and how contextual it can be and how it can fit. This is the first time that we even do things like that. And it's very unlikely that we're going to arrive at that type of experience before we take a step back and truly open a dialogue about people's feelings. The fact that we don't know indeed how our consumers react emotionally to things we put in front of them. And we insist that we drag them into experiences that we've created a product we sell is absolutely arrogant and a bit of an issue in banking, to put it mildly.
So what do you think about the technology that's now available in call centers where we have voice recognition, where the algorithms now that listen for your voice are able to tell whether you're emotional, whether you're angry, whether you're upset, whether you're happy, and feed that back and use that in decision making in terms of which call center person should speak to you and how they should react to you?
I saw that the other day. I think that is an amazing step. We're getting somewhere. We're starting to at least discuss this whatsoever. It isn't the be-all, end-all. In fact, there are so very few banks that even look at this whatsoever. One of them would be Cebanca in Italy. And I've just had an amazing chat with Roberto Ferrari, who understands the fact that you need to design around how your consumer emotes. And then the other example is maybe NAB in Australia, where Liu Long is doing the same thing, thinking of emotions. But other than that, there's nothing else.
Australia?
I'm sorry?
Who's doing that in Australia?
Lou.
I don't know. All right. So what about, there's the emergence of AI also, Duane.
Which is at Next Bank.
Oh, we must have lost you a little bit there. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Lost you for a moment, yes. Yeah. I don't know if that was your end or my end. But so one of the things that's of great interest to us on the show here is the emergence of AI. And we're getting to the point with pattern recognition now where computers and image processing will be able to tell not only the emotion of an individual that's looking at a camera or interacting with technology, but even to the point we might be able to tell if someone's lying by their facial expressions and the tone of their voice and tension. So how's this sort of technology, pattern recognition and facial recognition and voice recognition, where do you see this taking us in terms of the emotional design component?
That is an amazing step ahead, except I think that we're kind of confusing how this, or not understanding how the technology for these things is going to come about. I think we have capability and we're starting to learn how to slice and dice data. But I see a step where AI specialists are going to turn to banking and say, well, automotive can tell me what it's like to design the button for a door window, and the Burberry's can tell me what's the feeling when you wrap a coat around you. Can you tell me how people feel about money? And we can honestly not do so because we haven't done that conversation whatsoever. So in other words, it's going to get there in however many years it's going to take us. However, to get there, we need to take these conversations in banking before we can hope to automate them.
So which banks do you think are getting this emotional banking thing, Duane?
You know, everyone gets excited about it, which is an amazing thing. And I love hearing it. And people connect with it at an emotional level. And they understand that this is a missed step. I've even had conversations with bankers who felt genuinely ashamed for not having thought about it before. With that said,
there's a lot of other things bankers should be ashamed about.
Should be ashamed about. I agree. But this is so core, though, that it becomes an issue of, I love this, and this is absolutely what we need to do. However, how do we do this? What's the ROI of this? Which department should be looking at this? And more importantly, kind of how do we make this into money? And I absolutely understand that. This is not a hippie, fluffy topic. I want us to make more money, but I also want consumers to be felt and understood and be made money for as well.
Right. Sometimes we just need to do the right thing, yeah, not look for the ROI. So where can we find out about emotional banking, Duane?
Well, I have a website that's joannabloomstrom.com where I rant mostly, but I also have an emotionalbanking.com website where people can see what workshops I've put together around this topic.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining the show. Sorry we didn't have much more time to delve into it, but check out emotionalbanking.com or duaneablumstrom.com, and you can also link in with Duane on LinkedIn, and she's on Twitter. Your Twitter handle, Duane, is?
Would be Duane. Lundstrom, yes, everything. Thank you so much.
In the name. Thanks very much for joining us. So just before we go to the break, Finovate Fall coming up, New York City, September 16 to 17. Register now. Use the Breaking Banks 20 code for a 20% discount. And don't forget the Inner Tribe Regional Startup Competitions are heading to Cybos in September. In October, go to innertribe.com to check it out. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King. We'll be right back after this break.
It's been probably the best thing we've ever done, without a doubt.
In 2011, Duane Blomstrom and Maniga headed to the first Finovate in Europe.
We were a very small company back then, 6 people. We had decided that we were going to actually demo, which was a big step for a small company at that time.
After winning Best of Show, they grew to be a European market leader in personal financial management.
Pipeline essentially exploded as a result of this. It essentially put us on the map.
So why do they keep going back to Finovate?
It keeps us honest innovation-wise.
Register today for Finovate Spring 2015 in San Jose on May 12th and 13th and experience future fintech first.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin', a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin' app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
So, banks have a nice little exchange rate going on between themselves, but another, bigger exchange rate for you when you want to send money home or overseas. And they'll throw in some bank charges too, just for good measure. Not really fair, is it? But what if you could set your own exchange rate? That would be currency fair. Currencyfair.com is a unique peer-to-peer marketplace that means you get a better rate and get to bypass those bank charges. You can't say fairer than that. Currencyfair.com, the smarter way to send money home or abroad.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin' is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin' today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, this is Breaking Banks. We are live on the AM band in New York, Connecticut, New Jersey on AM 1160. And we are live on Voice America across 72 countries. Welcome back to the conversation. At this point in the show, we have a guest calling in from California. That is Eric Rice. He's the COO of Business Rockstars. We had planned to get Ken Rutowski on. Ken is, of course, the host of Business Rockstars. And it's now one of the top 10 talkback radio shows in the United States, continental United States right now. But Eric also doubles as the COO of Business Rockstars and the founder and CEO of a startup called TrepScore. So first of all, Eric, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks for having me. I love this show. Love the topic of Breaking Banks.
So tell us first about TrepScore, the startup you helped found.
What you found? Sure, yeah, very in sync with the last guest here. So we actually use machine learning. We're a ready available tool for entrepreneurs to be able to connect their APIs from different software tools, and we use machine learning and are developing AI that will predict and literally alert you to different things that are going on within the company and then deliver content relevant to solving those issues.
Okay. And where are you guys based?
We're based out of Los Angeles, out of Santa Monica.
Very good. Now, for those of our audience who haven't listened to Business Rockstars, tell us about that show, because it's a fantastic format.
Yeah, we are a two-hour daily show streaming live online. We're also broadcast on traditional radio throughout more than 175 stations nationwide, so we're playing pretty much 24 hours a day across the country. It's everything entrepreneur. That's our topic. So anything having to do with new companies, great ideas, investment strategies. We're launching out a series of how-tos and e-learnings and all these different components, but we're really a big hub for literally everything entrepreneur.
And you've had some phenomenal guests on the show. Can you tell me about some of those you personally have been some of your favorites on Business Rockstars?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of my favorites were on today. We have some pretty regular spaces on there with some really great mentors and local entrepreneurs. But we've had folks on here over the last year and a half, ranging from like Larry King and Damon John and a lot of the different entrepreneurs that you see on television. And we're, I think in the next couple of weeks, we're bringing the gentleman to the Prophet on. That should be a pretty amazing. Yep. But those are my favorites. Those are two of my favorites. And Gene Simmons, of course.
Gene Simmons.
How do you go wrong with that? Right?
He would have been an interesting guest. So these are, where are these startup or these entrepreneurs normally based? Are they all LA based, California based, or?
No, it's surprising. We're starting to see a lot more. A lot more business developing, startup to startup or startup to large brand in LA. And with that happening, we're starting to see a lot of companies coming in from Colorado, from New York, from Boston. And while they're in town locally for us here, we try to get them on the show. But most of our guests are local. You know, they're within 50 miles of Los Angeles. But there are so many companies around here right now that we're really picking through and finding some really, really cool guests.
So an interesting stat for you, I don't know whether you've heard this before, but Silicon Alley, which is what we call New York from a startup perspective, there's some great people here like the New York Angels and David Rose, who founded Gust, who are sort of really plugged into this. But Silicon Alley actually surpassed Silicon Valley in terms of investment in financial technology companies last year. So, Silicon Alley is starting to compete at least for investment in fintech startups, companies like Betterment, my own company here, Movin', and so forth. A lot of that's direct out of New York. Everything's going tech these days. So there's a lot of cities vying for, a sort of secondary investment and sort of startup. Austin has, of course, been, the center of South by Southwest. But LA is becoming a popular hub for startups as well. Given that you're based there, why is LA so hot, for startups right now?
For a few reasons. Number one, when it comes to technology, the thing that most people don't know is that the greater Los Angeles area produces about pound for pound per capita more computer engineer graduates than anywhere else in the country. We have UCLA, USC, Caltech, we have some of these great, Northridge, we have some of these great computer engineering programs locally. And for the last 30 or 40 years, they've been recruited away by Silicon Valley, moving up to San Francisco. And in the last probably 5 to 10 years, we're starting to see a lot of them stay here and start their own companies.
Right.
But the biggest piece of the puzzle here, why is it growing so rapidly here, is really all about distribution and media, right? Having your startup located in Los Angeles gives you an advantage to be on shows like Business Rockstars or to meet with not just people who work there, but the founders of ad networks, right, to try to gain better placement for your company. And plus, we have a huge fashion hub here, you know, New York is always going to take the fashion dollars and investment, and LA is going to be second. But we're starting to see a really big convergence in media and technology, and that's really fueling the fire here.
So would you say that as a, like, as Silicon Alley is sort of starting to form a real competency in terms of fintech companies, and do you think that that's where LA has the real strength, sort of the media tech?
Yes. I mean, the weird thing is that we were number three in fintech also. So there are a lot of really, really smart engineers here that are building some tools for personal finance, business finance.
Hey, don't try and steal our thunder from New York, dude, you know. New York's not doing too bad.
No one's stealing that thunder, trust me. New York's got the fintech down. But Chicago also is a great place where Ken and I are both from. We see a lot of great fintech startups out of Chicago, one of them being one of our friends of mine that I work with named Investly, which is creating a very cool product.
So, you know, how do you think this is going to play out over the next 5-10 years? You know, what do you think that startups are just going to be spread across the U.S. and you know, Silicon Valley is going to weaken in terms of its dominance, and it's going to be, you know, sort of much more, they're going to be just part of the pie? Or do you think, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the way this maps out over the next 5-10 years?
That's an interesting question that you posed to me, because I've got a very interesting view on this. And I'll start with something that doesn't make any sense. It'll make sense in the end. I've been playing poker since I was 6 years old. And over the course of the years, I've been playing it in, you know, casinos and poker halls and people's homes. And throughout that process, I became pretty good. And the moment that you started seeing poker players wearing sunglasses on TV and popping up, 17-year-olds, you had about a 9-year run. And from that time, when I started seeing these poker players become personalities, poker has really diminished in popularity over the last 9 years. The same thing is happening with entrepreneurship, right? Shows like Shark Tank and all these other places, they're commoditizing what is traditionally a very difficult thing to do, which I think is great. We all think it's great. Entrepreneurship will save this country without question. And the more information readily available, the better it will be. So over the next 5-10 years, the way I see it playing out is I see, and thankfully, someone agrees with me, but Intuit just came out and said that 40% of the U.S. workforce will be a 1099 or independent contractor by 2020. Yep. And I agree with them. I think that's a lowball number. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, it'll be more like 50%. And places like Los Angeles are really doing some great things with startups. The co-working spaces are fantastic. But the opportunity that is being created, where I've been a startup entrepreneur for about 12 years, my first 2-3 years in the business, you couldn't get a deal done with a big company to save your life. Now they're taking chances on working with startups, and that's gonna keep increasing as big companies lack in innovation and small ones keep providing innovation for them. There's always going to be a huge market here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think did you see Mary Meeker's internet report? Did you see her? Yeah, so, you know, the sort of stuff that's happening with Airbnb and Uber and people sort of taking secondary jobs, you know, that's also a function of the economy. People are sort of taking additional work, but, you know, they've got the freedom to choose the hours of when they work. There's also some really good research coming out about millennials and, you know, Gen Y, Gen Zs, in terms of working flexibility is very important to them. So I think that's another driver in respect to why people want to be entrepreneurs. They just, you know, they don't want to work for the man, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And I deal with almost all. I am a millennial and deal with millennials. I'm the top echelon of millennial in age, but I deal with them all the time. And the one thing I can say about, you know, them or us, whichever way you look at it, is that it's not a generation based on trading time for money. That's apparent. But the real solution for them is that they want to be thought of as executed. They want to be thought of as people who execute. And yeah, that's where the job market's going. It's not going to be renting people's time and title. It's going to be project-based. And I think when the country gets into a position like that, where I'm a company, I need a new website, I hire a website place, they get it done, I pay them, that becomes an efficient capitalist market, very efficient. And we're very far away from that right now.
So, you know, what in terms of the big industries in in LA. We've seen you know, Netflix and Hulu and others now starting to produce their own content. You know, do you see that this will also produce more independent filmmakers and more independent media companies, that the combination of these two forces, you know, like the emergence of this media tech and, you know, more entrepreneurs in the space?
Yes, and the shared economy has a lot to do with that. There is a company here in LA that just launched out, I believe, a couple months ago, and they do, it's a shared economy for film tools, right? So some of these cameras are $50,000 to $60,000 to buy, and this is a place where I have, if I have one, I can put it on the market, and someone else can rent it for the day for $120, and then send it right back to me within the same city, so I can pick it up at my house and drop it off. That's really spurring the creative side in LA. But I think what you're going to see out of Los Angeles is that this is really a media hub, and it's going to be very difficult to tell the difference between advertising and media over the next decade. Very difficult to tell. And that's where we're going to see the big boom in Los Angeles, is the fact that it's not about coming here for the Hulus and Netflix, which is an attraction and great. We also have YouTube and Google right here in town. But the real attraction, I think, here over the next few years is going to be the ad networks and some of the media plays that are really creative and coming out with some really, really cool things that are just different and easily monetizable. That's going to be the big push.
Yeah, we had Robert Turcek on the show last week, actually, talking about his book Vaporized. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but there's a lot of synergy in terms of what you're saying there. I think he's, I'm not sure if he's been on Ken's show. I know he's spoken at Ken's networking breakfast that he runs there in LA. But in terms of, you know, sort of this, the sharing economy, you know, we've got some other interesting emerging trends here. One of those is that we're starting to see the machine intelligence stuff. So I wanted to drill down a little bit into this with TrepScore and your experience on that. Recently, sure. an Oxford study came out showing the jobs that were likely to be disrupted by artificial intelligence. And but I'd like to get your feel, and they include things like bank tellers and loan officers and accountants and tax advisors and, you know, financial advisors, things like this. Anywhere that the human gives advice today, it's likely a machine will do it better. But let me ask you it this way. Where do you think jobs will be created as a result of the injection of AI into the world? Have you got a thought on that?
Yeah. No. First of all, before I even go into that, since I met you about a year and a half ago, every time I drive by a bank, I get mad. Now that I know how much square footage is wasted, how much money we're paying, you've made a great impact, and the stuff you're doing is a game changer. So, love that. The jobs I think will be affected by machine learning, artificial intelligence, are going to be a lot of the mundane things, right? Like service, basic service, hotel maids. Those will be triggered by AI. They already are. There's a company in LA doing that. A lot of the, I don't think you can get rid of bank tellers until you get rid of banks, because you still need a person. But a lot of the, the operator, daily operations, we're already seeing manufacturing getting wiped out, right? Like any of those jobs will be wiped out. But I'm not sold, and I was a former high net worth advisor, but I'm not sold that, and I love Wealthfront, I love the business, I love what they're doing. I'm not sold that that's a model for everyone, because it's a delicate thing. People's money is a very, like you said in the last segment, it's a very emotional thing. Jobs I think will be enhanced are going to be anybody who's a knowledge worker, like yourself, like myself, like anybody who has too much on their plate. Artificial intelligence, borders on dangerous. Yeah. I'm sorry, Brett. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's yeah, the time poor element is a strong, increasingly so.
And think of the things that you can do. Like, this is why, TrepScore started out as the Dun & Bradstreet of startups. Like, we have a very good way of ranking and scoring and predicting success, which will take years to be able to say is good. But we went right into the knowledge worker market and noticed that what we were doing, and just based on my own life, right? Like, as soon as I think of something, I Google it 17 times and I look for things, and before I know it, it's 42 minutes have gone by. Sort of multiplying that on the average person, the average entrepreneur spends 8 hours on Google every day. Most people don't know that, but we pulled 1,000 entrepreneurs. The average was 8 hours on Google every day.
Yeah, I love the Google.
But think of the mechanisms that could be drawn from that, right? Like if I knew what Google was supposed to be looking for and I could connect those two together, well, I'm going to save myself 8 hours a day.
Absolutely.
And that's going to multiply an economy. That's a big impact on an economy.
Fantastic. Well, Eric, thanks for joining the show. And give Ken our thanks. Tell him he's still got an open invitation to join us, that there are other radio show hosts out there trying to make a living.
Absolutely.
Eric,
I'll give him a tough time.
Please do. COO of Business Rockstars and founder of Trepscore. You can check out trepscore.com or, of course, listen to Business Rockstars on pretty much any radio show, any sort of radio network in the United States today. Thanks, Eric, for joining us.
Thank you, Brett.
Okay, guys, we're going to have a quick break. After that, we're going to hear another segment on Women in FinTech from Liz Lumley. We'll be right back after this break.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Move In is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Move In today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
So thank you, Brett, for that introduction. And here we are with our ongoing Breaking Banks Finextra series, looking at interesting women in fintech. Today, I'm sitting down with Nazat Gultekin. And you're a well-known advisor to the tech community and the fintech community, especially in regards to funding, which is always a big topic in this industry. So, I mean, recently you worked a lot with Tech City UK to foster the tech community in London. Take us through that experience.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. Delighted to be part of it. Tech City UK is there to foster the tech ecosystem, as you said, and I was attracted to be part of it because I've been a huge advocate of tech for many years. I've been in it for 15 years with my formation coming from Silicon Valley, where I spent over 8 years before coming to London. And I think this is really a reflection of how the industry has started to develop here in the UK anyway, but really I think shining a light on it and helping the companies and entrepreneurs to connect with the policy side, which is, of course, quite powerful, because one thing which I have observed here in the UK is that there has been a very active and genuine interest in helping the tech ecosystem here with the policy side that includes, for example, EIS and SEIS schemes, which are essentially providing tax incentives for people to invest into companies as angel investors. FinTech, as you know, has got a lot of attention of the government, especially the Chancellor, which also initiated a review of the sector, which I participated in myself as well, to really help companies, entrepreneurs, being a voice of them into the government and vice versa, and providing them an environment where we connect them with the private sector as well, leveraging also the expertise of the team members and having their network helping these companies to address a number of potential obstacles that they might have in terms of scaling up, which is clearly an exciting journey for a lot of companies, and that involves a lot of aspects to be managed. One is funding, and the other one is finding the right talent.
It goes beyond just helping them find funding. It's more sort of helping them form their business, scale up, find staff.
Absolutely. I think because I helped establish the Future 50 program, mm-hmm. which is a program designed for scale-up stage companies to help them across multiple areas and have it as a more of a bespoke program, if you will. We really leverage the private sector partners where, again, we perceive to have a lot of common challenges, as well as, again, utilizing the in-house experience and expertise. In my case, of course, because I work with a lot of companies across different stages of their life cycle, providing them access to different corporate partners and helping them strengthen their team and really providing, I would say, neutral perspectives and educational content in many respects as well.
So you mentioned the Future 50 group of companies that you were a big part of putting together. Mm-hmm. Now, a number of those companies are what we probably call fintech companies.
Absolutely.
Or financial companies. Yeah. I mean, given London's sort of historical center for banking and finance, you know, how much does fintech really dominate the tech scene here in London?
So I would say increasingly more, and as we, I guess, look at the technology news every day, we see more of the fintech companies. The first 50 companies had 7 fintech companies in it. We had 6 more companies coming in from the fintech. So 13 out of 50, which is 26%, which is not bad. And it's a good reflection of, again, I think the tech scene in the UK and in London specifically. Mm-hmm. I would say we see more of the consumer-orientated fintech businesses, i.e. those that are disrupting. The word needs to be used quite carefully, but the traditional
responding
way of...
to changes in customer behavior.
Yes, that's right. It's a better way of putting it. The traditional services that individuals or consumers will be getting from the banks, such as transferring money, peer-to-peer transfer, and currency exchange, of course, and the alternative finance as well, peer-to-peer lending, which obviously has the business end as well, but a company like Zopa, which is Future 50 company, transfer-wise, World Remit, again, Future 50 companies on the currency transfer and peer-to-peer remittance space. So we see more of these companies becoming much more relevant and scaling up and increasing their user base. Hence, I think, in general, we have more recognition of the fintech sector here. Mm-hmm. But we should not also forget that historically, it's not just very recently, that there have been a number of technology and software solution providers to the financial services industry. A software that
the old guard companies like SunGuards and the Mises and the Rolls.
Yeah, absolutely. As well as, of course, across Europe, there have been some very strong companies in that space or providing the software that enable, especially banks, I would say, what we call sell side, to put together the instruments across FX and equities derivatives and to be able to manage the risks. We've had those as well, and I wouldn't call them generation one necessarily.
Yeah.
Because I mean, maybe in certain respects they are, but they have been providing a very key functionality. So as we think about it, the banks last year globally spent $485 billion on IT. Yeah. So financial services vertical, as we call it, is a huge spender on IT. And historically, it was more on the hardware side, of course, the servers and all the gear that needed to go into the backbone. Mm-hmm. But more and more...
I can't tell you how many data centers I've toured.
I can imagine. So, of course, intelligence more rests on the software mm-hmm. now. So, they inevitably, a huge spending on IT across software and applications and so forth. So, we shouldn't really disregard that either. I think, mm-hmm. as we define fintech, it's not just anything that provides a different way to deliver the service,
exactly.
but equally providing more efficiency and functionality to existing financial services industry.
So now you're no longer with Tech City UK. So what's next for you?
I have been, again, in the tech sector and fintech, I guess, for a long period of time. And I continue to advise a venture capital firm that operates on a global basis. And fintech is one of the areas that they invest in. So historically, I've helped them look at those opportunities. And I continue to provide independent advisory also to companies in the tech space broadly.
So, I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit, because I know your background is more on the capital market side, trading floor side, which warms me to you, because that's my background as well. But, you know, a lot of people would argue that stuff like high-frequency trading and another electronic trading has done a lot to disrupt the capital market. So, you know, what about sort of the fintech technologies we're talking about now in terms of blockchain-style platforms? You know, do you think the trading floor is ripe for that type of fintech innovation style disruption?
I think the short answer is yes. A lot of the legacy systems have been working well and are working well, but need to be improved. And especially in today's environment where the margins are getting really thin on the trading side. I wasn't a trader myself, but I spent quite a bit of time, especially when I was at Lehman and Nomura, with the heads of IT for equities and equity derivatives departments. And they have to do a lot to improve on the data capture side to be able to process the transactions in a real-time basis and capture them in a real-time basis. But technologies such as blockchain, again, it's being discussed a lot, and I wouldn't claim to be an expert in this area, but I do think that it has applications across any transactional environment where there is the initiation and execution and the capture of that specific transaction, whether that's equities or around money transfer or whatnot. Mm-hmm. I think there would be various applications, and even what we generally call infrastructure technologies in the enterprise software space.
Because I think there's, in sort of those enterprise technologies, I think there's kind of a quiet revolution going on. There's a lot of press attention on, you know, you mentioned disruptive technology, especially in the consumer space, which gets a lot of attention. But I think, as you mentioned, the trading floor is always looking to improve margins, always looking for liquidity. And I think very quietly, they're going to look at some of these new innovations like the blockchain, and it'll have almost a bigger impact, I think, than the other areas of the bank. And I don't think it's being paid attention to enough. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, yes, because I think in the recent times, especially around cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, the attention has been more around the Bitcoin itself as
yes.
opposed to
yeah.
the underlying technology. But equally, what I was referring to just earlier with what I call the enterprise infrastructure technologies, if you look at what's happening now, that instead of using the disk drives, a lot of the real-time calculations are happening in memory. So there are data grid companies that provide the technology, and guess which vertical they want first? That's banking. Because
yes.
again, there is a huge amount of data and transactional data need to be processed and captured. And I have friends in the Valley actually that are the founders of the startups that are providing these technologies. And again, the first vertical that they address is
banking.
Mm-hmm. And after that, of course, retail, mm-hmm. Healthcare and telecoms sectors, again, where you generate a lot of data. But of course, with the banking sector, there is a lot of regulatory and compliance requirements as well, which make also data protection a big topic as well. So cybersecurity, we hear more these days. Again, I've spent a lot of time working with companies in the security space over years, either helping them doing the mergers and acquisitions or taking them public or capital raise. Now, again, attention is back to security because where we have, again, today, I can't remember the statistics, but the amount of data that's being generated, and again, in the banking sector, it's more important that the data is captured and secured appropriately. So all of these, I think, for new generation technologies that we see within fintech, and broadly, again, security is more of a horizontal area, but I think we'll find more of this, especially around data protection and identity and access management applications in the financial services industry much more.
So let's on our penultimate question, let's get off tech a little bit, you know, and I wanted to talk with you a little bit. You mentioned you worked at Lehman Brothers, and you were at Lehman Brothers in 2008.
Yes, I was one of these people carrying my box downstairs, although I waited for 3 extra days. It wasn't on the 15th.
Has that changed your worldview at all? I mean, how did that impact the way you view banking and what you do now?
Well, I think it has impacted it on one way, which is to say that I think the system became too complex in some of the areas of financial services industry, i.e. very complex instruments that were difficult to assess and in terms of the liability and the future value and so forth. And there was a lot of mystery going on there as well. But as I look at the side of the business that I was in, which is the advisory part of it, where we believed that we were actually adding a lot of value to the sectors that we were covering, in my case, obviously technology, because ultimately helping companies to raise capital, helping them to either sell to a strategic firm or helping private equity firms to make investments and taking companies public and so forth. So this is more on the corporate finance side. But of course, all this, what happened with Lehman bankruptcy, that brought a lot of attention to the risk and the compliance elements. So if you today look at the banks, and where they're hiring, mostly you will see that it's mostly happening at the risk and the compliance side, which is probably the most secure job that you can have in the financial services industry today. Whereas if you're more front office, like what I was, like I would call it. But again, I think a lot of the technologies that we just talked about, algorithmic trading and others, do you need X number of traders on the floor to do that? The answer is probably no. Mm-hmm. So it has ultimately, I think the technology and what has happened and approach to risk today has had a lot of impact as to how the banks are being run today, which in many ways are more conservative than before. But I think the role of, again, the advisory, and if a company is looking to buy another one and needs financing, I think that will still be there. But if you look at corporate banking and the retail banking side, of course, now with, again, peer-to-peer lending and so forth, there will be other opportunities.
Cool. So I've been asking everyone this final question, so I'm going to give it to you. You know, what's your top advice for a startup in this space?
I would say three main things that if I were a founder or a founding team. One is to really having the right team of people that have complementary skills, ideally, around the table. So secondly, obviously, being very focused and having the tenacity, because there are lots of ups and downs, and it requires a lot of persistency. And thirdly, I would say there is generally a starting idea for companies as to what they stand to do. But I think an initial thinking is quite important as it regards to the total addressable market and how the business model is going to be. Mm-hmm. It could change slightly over time, but that thinking needs to form very early on. And that needs to be the key selling point for it, and how to address various constituencies as well.
Excellent. Nozat, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. And Brett, back to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Liz. Another great interview. Enjoying Liz's contribution to the show. All right, guys, listen, July 2nd, it's just next week, it's our 100th episode of Breaking Banks. Can you believe that? 100 episodes. So we have something special planned. We have a monster show for you next week at Breaking Banks. So be sure to tune in. If at all possible, tune in live. go to voiceamerica.com and tune in live, and we'll see you there. Catch you next week on Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. See you then.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.